you. Register online today at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca. Prizes, information, and fun are waiting.
You are radio's best friend for supporting our annual fundraising campaign. Thank you from the bottom of our musical hearts.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, Simon Fraser University Campus Radio, streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.
Today on Wings, American author Dorothy Allison, best known for her book Bastard Out of Carolina, died November 6th. 2024. In her honor, Arlene Zoucha shared the following program featuring Allison's talk in 2013 to the newly formed Working Class Student Union at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It originally aired in the radio series Her Turn on Community Radio WORT.
Welcome to Her Turn, a program of news and information by and about women. I'm Arlene Zoucha. A special half hour on today's show, you may be challenged, you may be validated, but for sure you will be moved by the way activist Dorothy Allison describes her working class experience and analysis. So stay tuned.
Come with a warning label.
And well, she should.
We are going to talk about some forbidden things. Especially, we're going to talk about money and class.
That's proud working class activist, award-winning author, lesbian feminist, Dorothy Allison. She isn't afraid to talk about the things that may make other people nervous. Her semi-autobiographical novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, describes with brutal honesty the abuse she suffered at the hands of her stepfather. Made into a movie, it was initially banned, and the book is still banned in many schools because of its graphic depictions. The first person in her family to graduate from high school, Allison went on to get college degrees. She still remembers how it all started for her.
I got my education, the best part of my education, from paperback books, from stories and songs, from John Steinbeck, but also from Hank Williams' music on the radio, from James Baldwin and Ruth Brown singing Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. It's the education you get if you grow up in a family that, well, more than half of members live in trailer parks. More than half of my cousins went to jail. All of my uncles went to jail. We used to joke, some people graduate from high school, we graduate from the county correctional center. Early on, I realized that the reasons that my uncles were in jail were often really not what I would think of as actual crime. Driving cars too fast, you can get arrested for that. Yes, it's true, they were drunk. It was in the 1950s, they were driving pickup trucks. It's the reason I have so many stories about uncles rolling trucks. It's the quintessential working class experience. Car accidents, going to jail, visiting your cousins at the county farm. But that's a southern working class experience. I am actually not familiar with the Wisconsin working class experience, although I suspect it involves pickup trucks and mobile home parks, impetigo, all those little diseases that you pick up walking on the dirt with bare feet. These are the things that shape working class children.
From a young age, Allison had a thirst for learning, and unlike many working class kids, she had access to a life-saving tool, books.
The first books I read were books my mother got in trade. She was put in Tony home permanents. Do you know about those things? Yeah. My mother used to put in home permanents for all the women in the neighborhood. And in return, she'd get paid a little bit of money. But the deal she cut was that she had this daughter that liked to read. I had the largest collection of Reader's Digest books in the world. I didn't realize for years that Reader's Digest books were actually abridged. I thought I was reading the real deal. Shock. Shock. Mostly they're not books in our homes, or they're paperbacks. Paperbacks shared, paperbacks passed on. In my family, my little sister, who I adore, she's been to jail too. She has one bookcase. It's a specially built bookcase. She belongs to the Stephen King Book Club. Every time he does a book, she gets it. There's Stephen King and there's me. I have the grace of being on top. But frankly, the Stephen Kings are much dog-eared, and the copies of my books are pretty pristine. And it's a little bit embarrassing, but there you go.
In her sister, Allison sees the working class values of pride, grit, and fierce determination.
You have to know who you are. You have to take pride in who you are. My sister, who reads only Stephen King, has worked in the same factory for 27 years. She took the job when her daughter was born. Her daughter, who was born with profound birth defects. My little sister is a sharp-eyed, talented, working-class mama. She got her daughter named the poster child for child defects in Florida. You know what happens if you become the poster child? You get a year of surgery paid for. My niece has had between 5 and 7 operations every year of her life, and my sister got it paid for. My niece is actually the only child ever poster child 3 times. As a baby, I think she's 7, she got it again, and she got it again as a teenager. My sister is ruthless.
But a deep sense of shame can underlie the pride.
How many of you have had the experience of being in junior high, going to school 5 days a week and having only 3 or perhaps 4 outfits, trying to put together some kind of combination of outfits so that you are not subject to absolute humiliation? My sisters and I, my one sister was 2 years younger than me, my other was 6 years younger than me, and we had this struggle every week. What the hell are we going to wear? How are we going to put things together? Especially when, at that time, you were not allowed to wear jeans to high school. You had to wear little dresses, little skirt and blouse outfits. I'm rolling my eyes. And I can look back on it now, and it's absurd. And I can look back on it now and think about, well, that's in fact how I developed so much resilience. That's in fact how I developed so much attitude. But I don't think so. I think that in fact it's where I developed a crack in my soul. I think it's where I developed my innate sense of the inappropriate, and that I was the inappropriate.
Class in this country is not well understood. Allison explains a common misperception.
And it is not always the same, working class and poverty. But mostly what we have in this country are the working poor. And the working poor work, oh my God, terrible jobs for very little money, never enough money, and never enough sense of purpose, desperately trying to take care of your family. For most of my childhood, my mother worked 2 jobs. She was a waitress and she was a cook. And when she went offline on waitress, she went back in the kitchen and cooked. We needed every dime she could make. Why? The minimum wage in this country is set below a living wage. It will not buy you first, last, and deposit. So you'll never have an apartment. You'll never have a home because you have never been able to put enough money aside because you will not earn enough to do that. But to that, add children. Add children who get sick. Add working people who get sick.
What is it like growing up poor?
Growing up with never enough. Growing up with a sense of fear. A constant, pervasive, depressive fear. Worst period of my childhood was not the month that my mother barely survived having broken her back while working for the Mint Maid Company hauling crates of oranges. She collapsed a vertebrae. She wound up in bed for 4 months. There was a settlement. There was never going to be enough money. She limped for the rest of her life. That was bad, bad, bad. But worse, worse was the day my stepfather came home and sat in the living room and didn't get up. Sat in that chair for, I think it was 7 weeks. He'd go to pee. He'd let my mama feed him. But he wouldn't get up. He wouldn't go to work. There was no money. There was no movement. In Florida, there are hurricanes. And the hurricanes toss wind around and destroy buildings. But when the hurricane comes fully over you and you're in the middle, it is absolutely still. You can't barely breathe because there is an absence of wind. It is that central, hollow, empty place. That's poverty. That's poverty with no expectation of relief. That was my stepfather sitting in that chair, staring into the distance, like when he got up, if he got up, he was going to get himself a gun, and we were all going to die. I remember those 7 weeks. They were the worst of my childhood. I remember the hopelessness. Poverty is hopelessness.
For a few working-class kids, college represents a way out of that hopelessness.
To go off to college as a working-class kid is to begin to try to pass in a world to which you deeply want admission. Let's not lie to each other. I did not want to be poor. I loved my mother. I loved my family. I had a perverse pride in my family. I got to tell you, every uncle who went to jail, I was happy that he had made a dent in the world. This is not rational. This is a 13, 14-year-old girl looking at the world who's treating the people she loves with contempt, labeling them dismissible.
But while going to college was an escape from poverty, it came with its share of difficulties.
I wish I could say that it was a smoothing experience, that being invited into academia was all glory. But I remember driving to St. Petersburg, Florida, to go to Florida Presbyterian College. It was actually my backup. I was going to go to Michigan State. Do you know why I didn't go to Michigan State? I didn't have a coat. And I looked at what it was like at Michigan State, and it got right cold. And there was snow, and I was living in Central Florida. And I could go over to St. Petersburg to Florida Presbyterian. I was not a Presbyterian. Didn't matter. They were still going to give me a big old scholarship. I didn't need a coat. On such things, your whole life swings.
Allison jumped through a lot of hoops to get her ticket, as she calls it, to college.
State scholarships, church scholarships. I revived every church membership I'd ever had for a minute and a half. I even applied for a scholarship to Brigham Young University because I fell in love with my seventh grade history teacher, and she sent the Mormons to talk to me. Next thing you know, I was baptized a Mormon. I was still in love with her when I figured out those people were batshit crazy. They didn't even let women go to heaven. You had to go to a lesser heaven if you were female, and you could only get admitted to the higher heaven if you married a guy who had the priesthood. And I'm like, are you people crazy? So I left the church until I needed a scholarship. Then I went back and applied for a scholarship. Scholarships are wonderful things. I believe in them. I believe in giving a ticket to kids who have aptitude and desire and are willing to work hard. I have respect for the whole process of working hard. I have enormous respect for kids who put themselves entirely at risk to enter a world they know nothing about and are going to have to shape themselves to fit into, pretending that you've eaten oysters when, you know, the major fish group your family consumes is catfish. I can remember being fed oysters Rockefeller at a scholarship dinner and thinking this was really brilliant and kind of wonderful, but I didn't know how to eat it. Didn't know what fork to use. When you're a poor kid stepping into the world of the rich, you become all eyes. You watch how the people around you, what they're doing, what fork they're using, how they're speaking. You modulate your voice. You change your subject matter. You say, oh, yes, I've read that. When you haven't read that, you're going to run right home and read that book because somebody mentioned it and you, damn it, you didn't read it. And you're not going to let them know you haven't read it yet. You're running behind yourself constantly. And you live in a fog of shame so dense You have to cut it with your hands every morning to step out of bed. You're pretending.
Looking back, Allison still struggles with the psychological discord that being in a class closet can cause.
All these years later, I have these two conflicting voices in the back of my neck. One is grateful. They'll not mistake me. I would never, never be here. I would never have written books. I would never have become a teacher. I would never have gotten out of the South. I would have never done any of the things I've done if I hadn't gotten the education I got, and I got it on that ticket. So those people who would invite me to a luncheon, and I would have to be grateful. That was my job, sit there and be grateful. This is our young scholarship candidate. And I would smile in my little ragged skirt, knowing what I looked like, and knowing that I was supposed to look what I looked like, because they wanted to feel good. They wanted to be generous. And frankly, they were good. It's not a pose, it's not a semblance. They wanted to make a difference. Do not imagine that this is all a scam. Some of them want to be respected and have attention paid and be thanked. A lot of them wanted to be thanked. I was willing to thank them. Give me cash, I will thank you. It's an ongoing motif in my family and in my life. I was genuinely grateful, and I was genuinely horrified, because every time they sat me up on that podium, I was the animal. I was the creature in the zoo. And that's what I felt like when I drove onto the college campus for the first time with my ticket. Desperate, eager, and terrified.
When Allison walked onto the campus, here's what she encountered.
The vast majority of the students were upper middle class. They drove to Central Florida in sweet little cars. And I knew immediately that they would take one look at me and know who I was. But a miracle descended on me. You know what the miracle was? I went to college in the day of the hippie. I went to college in the heyday of dress yourself out of the thrift store because that's what's really cool. I bought used jeans, split them down the side, and sewed American flags so that I had those flappy bitches, you know? It was an anti-materialistic moment in American history, and I thought it was heaven. Because, in fact, it gave me the possibility of passing.
Lots of little things taken for granted by so many other students carried special meaning for Allison.
I really believed that the secret of the middle class was matching underwear. This is not a concept we had in my family. Your panties are supposed to be the same color as your bra? Who knew? But it didn't take me but about 3 days to figure out that all the girls in my dorm had matching underwear. I started hunting down matching underwear. If it goes that basic, if it's what you're wearing that nobody ever sees, then you're deeply, deeply conflicted.
Despite passing among her middle-class college classmates, and despite how far she has come today as an award-winning author, Allison says she will always acknowledge and live her working-class roots. And in fact, doing so can be a survival tactic.
The moment you get your ticket and you come to college, they define you as no longer working class. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you're about to have a college degree. Yeah. You're about to be solidly, prescriptively middle class. So that they define out of your reach all of those resources. Your whole community is suddenly defined as not your community. And you are defined as a danger to your community. So get your ticket, go to college. But you're still going to want to eat tuna noodle casserole. You're still going to listen to country music. You're still going to have attitude.
Another reason Allison has been able to accomplish all that she has?
People ask me, why is it you're such a success? How is it you got that scholarship, went off to college and wrote all them books? I was a baby dyke.
Yeah.
And people discount what that actually means, and it means a range of things. One, I expected that I had to struggle. I expected that I was not going to be acceptable and that I was going to have to manage other people treating me badly. That comes along with being a baby lesbian. It also means one other huge thing. I didn't get pregnant. Every other teenage girl in my family. I have more cousins than God made pebbles. My sister got pregnant at 15, and my other sister ran off because she thought she was pregnant at 15. That shapes your life. You can't even take the ticket when they hand it to you if you're carrying a baby on your head.
Allison's sexuality helped her find a way out, but living a double life with a foot in two different worlds took a profound toll on her.
It's complicated, though, because every moment in which you are being reduced, every moment in which you are actually eating your own soul, lying about who you are, trying to pass as someone who you are not, you are also growing something that you dare not show. You're growing a rage. You're growing a resentment. You're growing an anger that, if you are not very careful, will destroy you, not them.
This sense of rage shifted when Allison scored a stint as a visiting professor at Stanford University.
At Stanford, they actually had me in the ethics department, which I kind of liked. I got to talk about ethics. It's central to writing literature, yes, and it's central to my understanding of the world. But I'm a working-class escapee. I have a master's in anthropology and a sharp and astute perception of how the world is organized. And I went to Stanford, well, they paid me well, but there was this other thing. They wanted me to talk about ethics. They wanted me to talk about how the world was organized. They actually wanted me to be my difficult lesbian working class self.
Allison gained special insight during her semester there.
I had not thought about it in years, but when I went to Stanford, working with these young people, it came back on me. My memory of every time I had been so full of an almost uncontrollable rage. I used to walk all night long back and forth across that campus, just walking, because it was as if there were this trembling inside me that wouldn't stop until I was completely exhausted. Looking at the students at Stanford, it was like looking at all those kids I saw when I was 18 and 19. But there was something new layered on top of them. By the time you're 55, they're not aliens. You can't just dismiss them. You can't let your hatred put them over there behind this wall. You can, but you won't feel good about it. The thing I realized working with the young people at Stanford is that, Lord God, they were smart. Lord God, they were polished. They had had rhinoplasty and facial surgery. They had had their breasts enlarged or reduced. They had had trainers who had worked with them. They were the products of the middle class that are so astonishing. It's as if they are another species. Put them next to my cousins. Put them next to the young people in my family, my high school dropout nephews, my nieces with bad skin and guilt and shame all over their faces, my nieces who don't know how to dress, my cousins who are full of rage. And I found myself doing that with every young person that I worked with at Stanford. I'd look at them, and in my mind, I'd see little David, who went to jail at 12 for breaking into a phone machine and stealing all the coins. I couldn't, though, hate them. Not cleanly, because there was this other thing happening. Because I was teaching ethics. We were talking about ethics. And then it hit me. They were good. Do you know what I mean? They had good politics. Some of them were deeply religious. All of them had spiritual conviction. Some of them intended to spend their lives confronting some of the greatest evils of our generation. Some of them I know now because I keep in touch with them. They've gone off to Africa to work in food programs. They've gone off to India to work in farming programs. They're building water transportation systems in the Sudan. They're amazing. Their parents raised them to be full citizens. Their parents raised them to be generous and compassionate. They are good, God damn it! And I put them next to my nieces and my nephews, who I have to tell you are not good. What happens to the working poor? There are small miracles. Some of us come through. Some of us never take to shoplifting or breaking into phone machines or keying other people's cars. Some of us see Jesus at 13 and build our whole lives around religious conviction. Some of us have ambition. Some of us have talent. But even when we are good, we're not good enough. We're not good like those kids I saw at Stanford. We don't have that deep wellspring of confidence, that conviction of worth. There is no way around this. We don't get to be good. We don't get to be proud Stanford students who will go out in the world and change everything. Even if we do. And I can introduce you to some of the most amazing working class kids who got a college education, who have done astonishing work. Anthropologists, medical researchers, my friend Dr. Dawn, who was nominated for the Nobel Prize, working with Doctors Without Borders. I can introduce you to them. I can list them for you. We have done amazing things, us working class escapees. But we never feel good. We never feel like what we have done deserves any recognition or appreciation. We are not actually the people who are going to be expecting you to say thank you. We have no concept that we deserve thank you.
Addressing internalized classism may be the first step. Speaking directly to the working class students in the audience, but also to all who care, Allison asks some tough questions.
What does it mean to be good and ambitious, to be socially conscious, to be fully engaged, and grow up poor? What are the possibilities? Here you are. Here you are with your tickets. The life that I put together out of desperation and sheer luck is not going to be your life, because the world you're in is different from the one I was in.
How is it different? Allison thinks some of the attitudes surrounding class were better when she was growing up.
There was this sense that this democracy we have built was built in part because of the power of the working class. Unions were powerful and respectable and made a difference in people's lives, actually got them health insurance and decent wages, and fought the abuses of corporate capitalists who did not care if they destroyed their entire workforce if they just made a little more money. But now, that world has passed away.
Allison also sees the backlash against feminism getting worse.
It's really depressing to be 64 years old, to have spent my life largely as a feminist activist, and to find that so much of what we fought for Christ God, 30, 40 years, has been eaten away, so that in fact that glass ceiling is very rigid. The universities are terrible examples, particularly the sciences, in which very few women get any position or any tenure. We don't have a vital and active national organization for women calling attention to these things. Instead, we have that silly bitch writing that book, Lean In. Did you read that sucker? I could lean in if I had a nanny and three maids, and God, Lord, the kind of feminist analysis that abstracts class offends me.
Although the world today is full of challenges, Allison is encouraged by youth activism. She gave a tip of her hat to the organizing work that is occurring on UW-Madison campus.
When Sweetheart over here wrote me and told me that there was a working class students organization in Madison, Wisconsin, it was like, how the hell can I get my ass to Madison? You know that you must organize. This is Madison, Wisconsin. I saw you guys on TV 2 years ago. I know what you did. I know that you know how important it is to place yourself in the world, to teach your children a sense of pride, to offset the shame and fear that the institutions that they're going to work with are going to inculcate in them.
Full of heart and full of hope for the next generation, Allison wants them to learn the lesson it took her a lifetime to learn.
You get to be good. You get to make a difference. But you're going to have to learn to organize. I hope to God you organize for all our children.
Dorothy Allison, proud working class activist, award-winning author, lesbian, feminist. She was invited to speak by the Working Class Student Union, the first of its kind in the nation, focusing on the needs and experiences of first-generation, non-traditional, working-class college students. For her turn, I'm Arlene Zoucha. Thanks to editor Nola Pastor and musical consultant Sue Goldwoman for the music of Katie Lang.
Dorothy Allison died on November 6, 2024. She was 75 years old. Her published writings include a book of poetry titled Women Who Hate Me, a book of short stories titled Trash, and the semi-fictional novel Bastard Out of Carolina, which became a bestseller and was made into a film, directed by Angelica Houston. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose salons can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. I'm Wings series producer Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.